just an intro into the next session. Right? So when we're talking about all of these things, we talked about websites, we talked about virtual machines, naturally the next step of the evolution is how we actually connect all of these together. And of course, there's certain, or I should say various different services that you can use to do that, various different ways in order to solve the problem of communicating between websites and roles, or cloud services, virtual machines, so on and so forth. But more importantly, where do you stick all of the tons and tons of data that we produce these days, right, in a scalable way, exactly how we've been doing everything else? So this next session, we're going to go through that. We're just going to highlight some of the things that you should think about in terms of how, let's call it that bridge or that last part of your Azure solutions. And then, of course, after that, like I said, we're going to go into actual coding.
So just to kind of cover the rest of the building blocks, we're going to talk a little bit about the storage methodologies within Windows Azure, which includes both Windows Azure Storage and a couple of different database offerings now that there's persistent VMs. So like James talked about earlier, we would really like to be able to provide these building block services that are going to complement all the stuff that you have deployed within Windows Azure. So as you see in this slide, we have database, we have storage. There's also a traffic manager. James went through a caching demo this morning. We're looking at Service Bus for taking tightly coupled applications and trying to decouple them and provide a layer of messaging between them to be able to scale your workloads a little bit more independently as your demand comes through. We also have identity, which we're not going to cover in this talk. But there's a ACS service which basically allows you to integrate with Facebook, Live ID, Google accounts, and it just provides a single sign-on experience for people that are using your application. So if you want to be able to reach a broad audience, being able to use single sign-on from existing accounts is going to save your customers that are coming in, and you know, everyone hates having multiple accounts. So having that single sign-on experience is just one more thing you can offer your customer coming to your website. We also have the CDN that builds on top of our storage providing and allows you to move some of the data that you have sitting within blob storage out to 24 different edge servers and allows you to kind of meet the needs of faster downloads for people that are maybe outside of your particular region. So basically, once someone hits the request, the image or whatever is pushed out to an edge server, and then any subsequent requests from that edge server or will be delivered from that edge server and provide a nicer experience for people in that region to download things. So thinking about data management within Windows Azure, basically when the offering came out in late 2008, they introduced simply the storage. Windows Azure Storage, and that was the only means to store data within your application within Windows Azure. And that was a decent offering. I've started to kind of adopt that mindset, looked at NoSQL storage and Windows Azure Tables, which is basically just a row key and a partition key, and provides, you know, a nice entity set way of looking at things. Some people couldn't quite wrap their head around that, and I don't blame them, you know. People have been working in IT for, you know, decades. So why change something that isn't broken? So within, with launch, public launch, they added the, which then was called SQL Azure, which has now been refreshed to Windows Azure SQL Database, and basically provided a nice SQL environment sitting within the cloud, which was scalable relatively instantaneously. You could scale up to a bigger size. Now, because some people are looking at meeting higher demands of providing either the ability to have, you know, transparent row level encryption or requiring SQL CLR within their applications, we've looked to the virtual machine offering as a way of providing that full stack SQL server and giving people the rest of the scenarios that they're looking for. So let's kind of take a look at that for a brief moment. You've seen this slide before, but we just kind of want to reinforce the fact that we want to provide something that's going to last or basically guide you through having all your own physical servers in your on-premise environment, virtualizing out those servers within your house, and then looking to the cloud to scale out beyond what your data centers might be able to handle today. But it's all about providing that nice continuous environment and the same existing tool sets that you use today. And then when you do get to the kind of PaaSy offering and you want to be able to provide something that is looking to a little bit more of a cloud-based scenario where you might not rely on some of the features like SQL CLR and you just want to make sure that you can spin up a whole bunch of servers when needed, we hope that you look to Windows Azure SQL Database as a way of offering up your data if you want to stick within that relational means. So SQL running in a virtual machine, it's full SQL Server. There's no limitations anymore because we are honestly running the entire SQL Server stack sitting within that persistent VM. It's a relatively low cost of ownership for existing applications because you'll be able to just migrate your existing data sets into that new VM environment that's running, you know, the fresh stood up server of SQL Server that's running in the cloud. You basically have the same flexibility and control that you have today. It's just hosted off your site and in an environment that's a little bit more highly available to most. And then it's managed infrastructure. So, you know, you're still responsible for maintaining it as it is today. However, you know, you have the ability to add in additional servers if need be. We looked at a slide earlier that explained the fact that we can do SQL mirroring within Windows Azure to provide that kind of fault-tolerant load that we're looking for that you may or may not have today. Some of the common scenarios is basically moving applications to the cloud. We're looking at multi-tiered applications that are running, you know, the data, potentially some other services that are running in addition to just your database. We basically want to provide you the ability to develop these solutions quickly, which is why we're basically taking everything that you have today and just pushing it out to the cloud. We want to make sure that you have the ability to back up your database. So all of the tools that you use today sitting in Windows Azure, you can take all your backups, run them on-premise, and not have any on-premises, and not have any issues connecting out or scaling back if you need be. And then obviously, we want you to have the ability to scale out whatever you have on-prem into the cloud in maybe the terms of bursting out your web front end or providing additional servers out in the cloud to kind of replicate out your SQL environments. So with that, we'll take a little peek over on how to get SQL Server set up in a VM. Getting a little bit better at this whole switching thing. But basically, I have here, wrong demo machine. Three. There we go. So we have here the existing SQL Server instance that I stood up in an earlier talk. And basically, it should be nicely provisioned now. One thing that we're going to want to do is attach a couple of empty data disks. As I mentioned earlier, the last thing you want to do is kind of... What are you pointing out here? Do you need it bigger? Zoom it in a little bit. So what I did there is I attached an empty data disk. Essentially, the reasoning behind this is we don't want to have our operating system and our data sit on the same VM just in case something happens to that OS disk. So what I'm doing here is I'm just adding two 1 terabyte drives. Oh, I might not be able to do that if it's small. Let's scale this down a little bit. Just add two disks. Oh, yeah, no. forgot I set this one up as small. Let's move over to my other SQL box that I have up and running, and we'll just connect right into that. Awesome. Now we have the ability to actually right-click and hit manage here. So once you add those disks, basically you come into an environment here where you're going to have to make sure that you format and get those disks prepared for any kind of feature set you need. So basically we're going to go into disk management here. Am I losing it? Thank you. Big round of applause to the AV guy for helping that out. Thank you. So basically, we're going to go into our disk management, and these two disks at the bottom here would just be grayed out. So to get these up and running, basically you right-click on the grayed out disk portion here, and you have to initialize the disk. And that's going to make it enabled. It's going to attach the disk into the VM so the operating system knows what's going on. And then you can right-click here, and you can just create a very simple volume, and it's just going to go and reformat this for NTFS. I did the same thing for disk 3. You just initialize the disk, format the disk, make sure it's enabled. You just provide a drive letter, and you're basically ready to go. So to pull up something that we all know and love, bring up SQL Server Management Studio. And there's a couple of things that you're going to have to do to ensure that you have everything set up to move to those disks that we just created. And basically, that's all configured directly through this VM here. And just connect into the box. All right, so if you go to databases, I've actually installed AdventureWorks. Everyone knows and loves AdventureWorks. And you just go in and you go to properties here. From the properties, basically what you want to do is go into permissions and make sure that you've enabled a SQL version so you can connect out through our box. But we also want to make sure that we provide our file pass here. Just bear with me 1 second. I don't know what happened. Checking the options. Anyone in the audience? Sorry for doing this. I can't remember where the disk settings were. I think it's in the full VM or the full server, right? Database settings. There we go. Yeah, so it's at the database level. You go into database settings. And then we configure the data logs and backup down here. And I think you're going to Windows plus this. So essentially, that reformatted drive we created here, SQL data, is going to host our data in a data directory. And then you see the AdventureWorks data here. And the logs creates a backup and a logs folder in our G drive. And that's basically what I've set up here. So that gets that portion. And there's my magnifier kind of politely clicking through, finally. So now we've configured the storage. We know that that's going to be backed off of those two drives we can connect to. Basically, what we need to configure next is adding that additional security role. So we're going to go into security here, logins, add a new login, and we want to enable SQL authentication. So we're going to say I'm a new login name and I have a password, a super secure password. And basically, for the time being, I'm just going to uncheck enforce password policy. You want to do this, but I just want to make sure that my password doesn't expire at any point in time here. And then we'll just provide the default database as the AdventureWorks database, and that will create our new user account. So now if we want to be able to connect into our VM, we have, you know, a nice SQL user that our application can use to connect in. We don't have to worry about having the Windows credentials that you basically have to set up AD to be able to provide. So this gives us a nice, easy way to get in there. The last thing that we need to do is ensure that firewall. We want to enable our firewall settings. And in order to do this, Windows Firewall Advanced Settings. There we go. We're going to click on our inbound rules. We're going to create a new rule. And essentially, we're going to open up a port. So we'll click Next. Everyone knows the default port for SQL Server is 1433. So we're going to open up 1433. We'll hit Next. And we basically just want to allow a connection to connect to this database. So we'll keep going. All the defaults work out fine. And then we'll want to create a name for this. And that's just SQL input. All right. And there we see that we've created a new SQL input firewall role. So if you remember earlier, we actually said, you know, anything coming through the load balancer is definitely going to have an endpoint here. So we'll have to enable a new endpoint in the Windows Azure portal to be able to allow that traffic to flow through. So we're going to open up SQL, TCP port 1433. And this is something we could mask just using a different public port. We just have to make sure that we provide that when we go to connect to it. So that's going to take a minute to spin up. And then we should be able to just connect right through Visual Studio or SQL Server Management Studio. But we'll get this all up and running from here. So our app name is MySQL demo.cloudapp.net. We created a user and my ultra secure password. So when this spins up and it's ready, we should be able to go in and connect. Well, that's happening. Let's switch back to some slides just for a minute. And we'll just let that spin up. So as we're waiting for this, let's get everything spun up for our next demo, just so we can kind of keep things flowing. Because everyone wants to start hacking away at stuff, right? People are going to hack away at stuff. I'm here all day. All right. Good to know. So we'll actually just go out and create a, we're going to be creating a SQL database. There we go. So our new endpoint here has been created. So we should go back to Visual Studio here. Sorry, what'd you say? Good call. TCP. Oops. No. Open user default database. Forgot one security rule here. So let's go in database, AdventureWorks. We'll go down to the security table and make sure that our user gets pushed into here. New user. Hold on, there is an easier way to do this. just going to go with the one that I set up last night. Store. There's one more step, and it's just enabling that user to the actual database and making them a DB owner. There we go. We go into Server Explorer. Store. Azure DollarSign 123. Select. Customers. AdventureWorks. Tables. Okay, there's DB, or there's a person here. Person. Dot contact type. There we go. And we actually pulled all that information from a VM sitting running SQL Server within Windows Azure. Pretty exciting? A little bit. So just a quick view back to the slides. Windows Azure SQL database, relational data store in the cloud, doesn't quite offer the full features of SQL Server, which is why we show you setting up SQL Server within a VM. It's fully managed, so Microsoft's taking on the hard work of making sure that it's scaled out properly, that you know all the tasks running in the back end are working prim and proper. You do have the ability to scale that up and down when need be, and there's a number of pricing to do that. There is also another scenario that I'll talk about later, but basically we also provide a lot of drivers for additional languages. So if you're using something like PHP, you can still connect out to a SQL Azure database or a Windows Azure SQL database, or you know your SQL Server sitting in a VM. Obviously, because we want to provide that layer of consistency, we want to make sure that you're using the same tooling as you do today, which is why we're showing you, you know, running it out of Visual Studio or SQL Server Management Studio. You have the ability to basically connect to the database, you know, with the existing tools that we use today. Additionally, there's a Silverlight version of SQL Server Management Studio that we run directly out of Windows Azure Instance. So even if you're, you know, out at your grandma's house or your parents' house for Thanksgiving and you get that call and something's going on with the database, you still have the ability to, you know, pull out your netbook, connect in and manage SQL directly from a nice web-based interface. So with that, we'll just go ahead and create a really quick SQL Server or SQL Azure Windows database in the cloud. And we already have it up and loaded, so we can see how easy it is to simply just click on Create a SQL Database. All we need to do is provide a name. My Azure SQL DB. You can choose either web or business. Right now, the only difference between the two is the sizing. Everything sits on a common layer of features. So you can use 1 gigabyte, choose an existing server, and hit OK. It's pretty simple, right? A couple of seconds, we already have a SQL server spun up in the cloud. Pretty exciting? If you actually need to create a new server, you can go into the Servers tab and hit Add. And this is where things get a little bit more complex. We'll create a login name. We're going to allow Windows Azure to connect. That creates our nice server for us. Within here, we can go and configure. Oops. We can go and configure firewall ports to open up. So if you need to add that whole span, I've already added one King West in a demo earlier today. And then you do also have the ability to turn off that Windows Azure Services connectivity if you need to. So just with a couple of clips, that gives us a nice easy way to spin up a Windows Azure SQL database in the cloud. And you can basically use this for many of your applications today, with the slight exception of the SQL CLR support. You'd have to use the VM version for that. But a lot of other scenarios, there's a few data types that aren't supported. But you can do quite a bit within the Windows Azure SQL database. Just to kind of give you a background of what's going on in the behind the scenes, everything still connects through TDS. So it is literally using the existing technology that SQL Server is built upon. Everything still goes through 1433. The connectivity is the exact same. It's just the feature set's a little bit diminished. But essentially, this does follow the same sort of model that the Windows Azure Storage does, where you do have a primary and two replicas sitting somewhere within the same data center. And this gives you, you know, the ability to have that failover. So if your primary node goes down, it elects a new primary from one of the secondary instances that are spun up and starts serving the data. Now, some people are going to be curious about how quickly this data actually gets replicated. And it's a little bit of a lag time, but it's a little bit less than you'd be pretty surprised. I think I found within 5 minutes, it's pretty much there. But there's not too much of a guarantee as to how much, like how fast it will get there. But with the replicas being within the same data center, it does happen relatively quickly. There isn't too much network latency that's going to be an issue. SQL federations, this is that extra little piece that's sitting on SQL Windows Azure SQL database that I talked about earlier. Essentially, what this provides you the ability to do is have multiple Windows Azure SQL database instances spun up, and you can shard your data across all these different instances. So if you think about how you have a really high-scale application, if you think of something like Ticketmaster, and they have to sell thousands of tickets in a matter of seconds when, you know, Celine Dion, let's go with Celine Dion, has a concert in Quebec. Basically, they can just spin up a whole bunch of small Windows Azure databases. They can say, let's use the scalability target of, say, the section of seats. So if you think of all these seats that we fill today, we can literally take a row of seats and say, this database is, you know, for this row of people here. And that gives your application the ability to send smaller amounts of requests to individual database servers and just make sure that your application is nice, like highly scalable just by separating where the data actually has to land. That's a nice little demo or a nice little graphic there. We also just announced not too long ago, James alluded to, SQL reporting. So basically, it's a lot like the reporting services that are on-prem today. A couple of slight differences, but now offered as a service in the cloud. And you can connect directly to your Windows Azure SQL databases, generate your reports, and the feeds that come out of these reports are in different formats. You can actually get an Atom Pub view of the data. So if you're connecting with additional languages, PHP, Java, basically you can just consume all this in Atom Pub. and render your reports out as needed. Now, we still provide, you know, the nice integration with the tooling that we have previously. So if you run reports today, this is an easy way to offset your reports into the cloud. But this leverages, Windows Azure SQL databases today. SQL Data Sync. SQL Data Sync is an interesting offering. It basically allows you to synchronize the data that's sitting within your SQL server between either two cloud databases or an on-prem and a cloud database, and really from on-prem to potentially multiple cloud databases. And it's a very simple thing to do. You download a small agent that just makes sure that it's sending the information on an interval that you specify and keeps all of your databases synchronized. It could be across data center, across region, really just, you know, whatever you can come down to configure. Azure Data Management, talking about storage now. Basically, we provide REST-based services that allow you to interact with all of your storage needs. So if you wanted to upload a number of files, you can use the REST interface. You could also use the wrapper to that interface that's provided as the storage client in .NET. There's a number of other clients coming out, PHP support, and a number of other languages. But essentially, because we have that REST-based endpoint that you're hitting, you could essentially upload anything like an image or a movie into Blob Storage and just provide a straight URL directly to that image and have someone download it. Now, there is a full set of ACLs that can go on top of this. So if you wanted to provide access control and only allow certain people to download that movie or whatever, you have the ability to do so. So this is the list of storage libraries that we've, some of which we have provided, some of which are not really provided at this point. I haven't seen the Erlang one. I think that's a community edition, but they're out there. Some of the new features. An existing feature of Blob Storage was something called a shared access signature. And essentially what this allowed people to do is create a URL with a unique token within it. That token would identify that someone had access to that particular blob for a particular period of time. So you would provide a start date, time, end date time, as well as the storage credentials, and it would basically get hashed out into this token. We've now introduced the ability to do this across Windows Azure Tables and Windows Azure Storage Queues. So it provides a nice clear offering across all of the storage services and enables you to have applications send requests out to storage without requiring the actual credentials to get there. And that's a really interesting offering. You also have improved manageability. So we enabled the ability for geo-replication, which is on by default when you create a storage account. You can go in and turn that off if you want to opt out of it, but the ability to do so is there. We also provide some great storage analytics and metrics, so you know how many transactions you're hitting against your storage account over a period of time. The reason this is important is it provides you the means to figure out which calls to your storage might be taking way too many calls to do so, because you're getting charged by the number of transactions that go out. So for every, I think they just upped it to 1 million storage transaction calls, you pay a cent. So if you think about it, you're sitting there, you're iterating over a call, and you're sending all these storage requests up there. Just sitting there and firing away could be costing you a lot of money. So you want to use these analytics as a means to figure out where your application may potentially have bottlenecks, or where it might be costing you a little bit more money than it should be. Then Windows Azure Tables, as I mentioned earlier, it's a partition key value pair. So you have a partition key and a row key that identifies a unique entity, and that entity can have up to 252 properties in it. The reason it's 252 is we take three properties away from you. You need the partition key, you need the row key, and we include a timestamp in there to generate an e-tag so you know when, or for concurrency checks, if you wanted to make sure that someone hasn't gone and replaced the item in the table before you go and try and add a new record. This also has a REST API, so you can literally use the OData syntax to query the tables that are sitting within Windows Azure Table Storage. And once again, fully managed PaaS offerings. So the reason there's a partition key there is to help partition your data whenever it's under heavy load. So if you have a number of things in different partitions and you think of countries as a way to partition data, if we have a whole bunch of people hitting the Canadian node, we basically want to scale that out so it doesn't affect the latent, like it doesn't affect our application. So what the system will do behind the covers, it will actually spin up multiple servers, move the data into those, move the Canadian partition across those three servers, and provide a way for all that data to be accessed by routing and load balancing all the users that are trying to hit that endpoint. So just a little bit of the concept of storage. Everything gets rooted from your account. So if I create a Windows Azure Storage account called Corey, that would be the start of the account point. Then you provide a table on top of that, which is just a means of partitioning your data out again into different logical units. So if you want to think of this in terms of a relational database, you could actually separate all of your entities into a different table. Now, this isn't necessary, right? You could stack up a whole bunch of different entities of all different sizes within one table, but to help wrap your mind around it, it's a lot easier to separate these tables out into the entities that you want to store them, name them appropriately so you know when you're querying this data out that you're getting the records that you're expecting to get. Then the entity, once again, is up to 252 additional properties that actually contains the data that you're looking to retrieve in a manner that's almost like a SQL query. Just reinforcing the fact that there's no particular fixed schema. So this does say, you know, first name, last name, birthday, but there could be an additional property in any of these rows. And then the highlight of that date under birth date is if you don't actually provide a value for a column that's supposed to be there, it will be defaulted to whatever the data type default is. So May 1st, 76 would be the defaulted date time, I believe. And then moving forward towards adding additional rows in the future, you just need to make sure that your schema that's sitting underneath it is serialized in a fashion that will allow you to move forward. So if you're not going to be providing a value, adding canoeing to Nathan is going to be rather interesting. But when you try and query an existing row like Wade and you don't have any data there, it could potentially error out. So you want to make sure that the properties that you add are optional properties, just so when you move towards building out V2 of your application, any existing records can get pulled back into your schema. A little bit more on Windows Azure Blob Storage. It's unstructured data, and there's a couple of different types, but every storage account has up to 100 terabytes of storage, and you get 5 storage accounts by default within your Windows Azure subscription. So that's quite a lot of data. Anyone think they can fill their movie collection, 500 terabytes? No? And again, geo-replicated by default for disaster recovery. And everything runs basically off of a RESTful API. One additional note is basically the two different types of data allow different connectivity to different aspects of how you want to store your data. So you notice at the end here, we have page and block blobs. Block blobs are optimized for streaming content, or if you think of it in terms of movies, pictures, maybe a Word doc or something along those lines. If you need read-write access and you need random access read-write, you're better off going with a page blob, which is why if you think back to the VM talk, all those VHDs are getting pushed into Windows Azure page blobs because they need the ability for random access read and write, obviously because it's an operating system, right? We're modifying files on the fly all the time. So thinking about this as a grand scheme of things, you have your account, Contoso. You have a container which can logically separate the different data. Oddly enough, that's actually also a scale unit. So if you think of how the partition key works in table storage, a container also offers that flexibility of moving that partition across multiple machines so your load gets offset by all the requests that are coming in. Then on top, within those containers, you add your blobs. So this is all your pictures or movies or whatever you have to serve up to your customers. And then essentially you just choose the type of blob that's that actually represents the data that you want to store. So the Windows Azure Storage architecture, basically everything comes through a virtual IP address, gets pushed into the storage front end. That's what decides where it needs to route your particular, like which server it needs to route your particular request to. So that's how we manage the load balancing between multiple instances. You do have the partition servers that you can push out the multiple partitions to, and it's just really just a big distributed file system. So that's where you see, I don't know how well you can see it, but the first partition server has many little blocks in front of it, because that's hosting up a lot of content. But then when those requests start firing in, that secondary partition server has one particular block of information. That's when it starts to scale out. So the existing server still has what it needs, but that other partition server is taking some of the load off the traffic that's coming through and serving up all the information. Now, obviously, these ones are the partition masters, and you still have the two copies out there. So if one of these were to fail, you'd have the ability to just, it would elect the secondary partition up, and the storage architecture doesn't cripple at all. So for scalability, basically this is all the partitions, and basically partition one becomes hot and starts moving over to a different server, which then the additional partitions might actually get adjusted along as well, so they get moved off to a different server, so the traffic that's coming in towards those two separate partitions aren't once again fighting for bandwidth. And the load balancer is smart enough to figure out which way or which information it should be sending to which server. Then when server or when partition one isn't really active anymore, it moves it back into the main storage area and then shuts down the additional server that it spun up to handle the load. So for the scalability, partition keys need to be a unique identifier in order to be able to move those tables out. So the last thing you really want to do is have everything stored in one partition. You want to make sure that you do kind of segment your data out into partitions. The row key needs to be globally unique within a partition, right? So the row key is supposed to identify a single entity across an entire partition. So you can share row keys across partitions, but you can't have the same row key within a single partition. And then obviously both keys matter because the scalability targets that you have rely on both those keys to find the information. A single request can pull down up to 1,000 pieces of information. So those keys have another purpose is to serve up additional requests after those 1,000 records come through. So if you have 2,000 records within your table storage, you're pulling down 1,000 of them within your first request. what also comes down is a continuation token, which is a combination of the partition key and the row key of the next set of records. So you need to keep that in mind as you're building out your application. What happens if I have more than 1,000 records here? I'm going to need to make sure that I check for that continuation token, and I go back to the server to grab any additional records that may have been left behind. So we're going to talk briefly about the service bus, and I have a demo, which is should be pretty exciting. But a lot of applications in the past become very tightly coupled. You know, you rely on all of the services that are in the back end. So you have your application in the front. It talks directly to your shipping service. And basically, everything comes in line. And the full process is the users waiting while the front end store communicates with the shipping service in the back end. Now, the problem with this is if anything goes wrong with any of the components, well, then the people on the front end start missing out. If there's no way to communicate with that back-end shipping service, the users at the front are getting a 500 error or something along those lines, and they can no longer use your site. How to fix this is we start introducing concepts to build out a loosely coupled system. So we introduce a message queue. In this circumstance, we're going to use the service bus queue. But essentially, what this allows us to do is our store front end sends a message off to our message queue. That gets queued and then pushed in turn to our shipping service, and then everything's happy. So if our shipping service were to go down, we continue to send messages into our order queue. The only thing is until that shipping service comes back online, the items just sit around in the queue. Once it becomes available again, we start processing those messages, and our system's up and happy. So if we think about this in terms of having multiple front ends, because we're thinking, you know, cloud scale applications, we're going to have multiple web servers sitting in front of it. We can send those multiple requests off to our order queue, and we can scale our back-end services independently to handle all those requests. So we basically have taken a system that had a tight reliability on this back-end system and provided the ability to scale up our front end to meet demand and our back end to meet separate demand based on the number of messages that are flowing through our system. So with that, we'll go to a quick demo here. So basically what I've done is I've created a very simple console application, which is essentially going to read out from a service bus queue. So I've gone in and I've pulled down the Windows Azure Service Bus, Microsoft.ServiceBus bits from NuGet, and that's going to basically give me the functionality to use this queue client. The queue client is set up in the back end to leverage Service Bus queue named Cori. And if you look at the app config here, at the bottom of the config file, we actually have a Microsoft.ServiceBus connection string, which basically points off to that service bus connection and has a shared secret that allows us to authenticate with that service bus service. We also have a message sender, which is basically going to be a standard ASP.NET MVC app, and the application itself also has connection off to our service bus queue right here. So basically, it's going to create a queue connection. We're going to use the brokered message service, and we're going to send out messages directly from here. So we just jump back and turn on our receiver into this console app, turn on our local. If we can get them side by side here. So if I type a message, oops, hello, Toronto. So as you can see, basically I type in a message, hit send, that gets sent up through the Windows Azure Service Bus, And then our console application is going and reading to see if there's any messages in the service bus and pulling those down and displaying them on the screen. So to make this exciting, we've gone out and deployed, I've hijacked coreyfowler.azurewebsites.net back off of James, and we've deployed this so you can actually send live messages from either the web or anyone in the crowd that's sitting on an interconnection right now. And I'm going to follow along here, and I can actually go in, type in a message. Anyone out there? There we go. We have messages starting to come in. Now, because our ASP.NET application is using jQuery Mobile, we have the ability to open up an emulator here that James showed earlier. We'll just pop in the URL here. And now I have the same experience on my iPhone emulator where I can say, hello from device, and hit send. There we go. Time for a break. Time for hackathon. Yes, someone's excited about hacking. That's awesome. So that gives us a nice, easy view into Windows Azure Service Bus. Lots of people in the audience. There we go. So essentially what we did there is we spun up an ASP.NET MVC site, which is going to connect out to our service bus queue. And people can connect through from the internet. And our application that's sitting locally on my machine was pulling that information down from the queuing system and displaying it out to our console app. One little piece is Hadoop on Windows Azure. Does anyone know what Hadoop is? A couple people? So Hadoop is a distributed file system for managing big data. I just wanted to call out really briefly that there is the ability to try out a preview of what Hadoop may look like on Windows Azure. It's at hadoop.onazure.com. But essentially, Microsoft has been trying to adopt a little bit more of an open ecosystem. So being able to provide an open source big data solution like this is really exciting to be able to see. So if you're using Hadoop and want to try it out, we've also built a JavaScript interface on top of it. Instead of having to run Java, we've basically simplified it down to JavaScript commands, and you can do relatively the same stuff that you do currently today, sitting within our JavaScript console and having the backend spun up on Windows Azure. So just to summarize, basically we want to provide some really great services on how to glue your applications together, maybe getting you thinking about cloud scale applications, taking a little bit less dependency on those tightly coupled systems, and introducing a little bit of a messaging layer in there, hoping to provide out a greater solution in a highly scalable environment. And basically, we also wanted to provide the cloud on your terms, right? We came out originally with this grand scheme and vision of having these highly scalable applications, but we also recognize that there is needs for having persistent VMs, as well as, you know, just things to get you up and running quickly. So we've gone out and tried to provide some greater feature set of services for you to consume.